This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. I'm speaking with Gina Oshner, who teaches at Columbia University, where she also directs the Portals Writing Conference. She teaches with the Seattle Pacific Low Residency MFA program. She has been awarded a John L. Simon Guggenheim Grant and a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. Her stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Glimmer Train, and The Kenyon Review. Gina Oshner is the author of the short story collection, The Necessary Grace to Fall, which received the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, and the story collection, People I Wanted to Be. Both books received the Oregon Book Award. A novel entitled The Russian Dream Book of Color and Flight received the Grub Street Book Prize in 2011 and was long listed for the Orange Prize in 2010. Gina Oshner lives in Kaiser, Oregon, and she joins us today in the KABU studios. Gina Oshner, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's my sincere pleasure to be here.
Today we're going to talk about your new book, The Hidden Letters of Velta B. This novel is a poetic story about family relationships. It's also a story within a story. The narrator, Inara, a Latvian woman, is dying, and during her last moments on Earth, she shares her grandmother Velta's letters with her son, Maris. Young Maris inherited extremely large ears and the gift of near ultrasonic hearing. Gina, your new book, as I said, The Hidden Letters of Velta B, is told from the point of view of Inara, who is dying of lymphoma. She is sharing the stories of her family, their village, and Latvian history with her grown son, Maris. And Maris grew up being teased and tormented by his classmates and others because he has these extremely large furry ears and hears not only things that other people can't hear, but also true heartaches lurking beneath his mother's confessions to him. It's quite an extraordinary ability to have. Can we start with a reading from the
Absolutely.
Beginning of Hidden Letters of Velta B to hear a little bit more about how she is telling okay. Maris the stories?
Absolutely. So this does come right from the beginning. Your first day of third grade, the leaves crisped on the trees, curling orange, red, yellow. They crunched like brittle paper beneath our feet as we walked down our lane. The closer we drew to the school, the slower you moved. We spied other kids galloping toward the schoolhouse, their mothers in tow, juggling book bags, purses, and mandatory first day gifts for the new teacher, yellow apples, embroidered handkerchiefs, chocolates. You had no book bag. I had no gifts. This was our third attempt in as many years to get through the dreaded first day. I had a pair of extra large aviator muffs, and these I slipped over your extra large ears, as much to protect the tender cartilage as to dampen the colossal noise of the schoolyard. Outside the wooden school doors, you grabbed my sleeve, turned to me. I know I am peculiar, you said, but am I too peculiar? The verbal torment at the hands of schoolmates, the pain inflicted by well-intentioned neighbors, that's what I heard in your voice. What I said, my hand on each of your narrow shoulders, Maris, you are fearfully and wonderfully made. It's a verse from the Psalms, one of my favorites, and I said it because I know the power words have. I've read Genesis. I've read how God spoke every blade of grass into being with three little words, let there be. The words, all potential, all possibility, speaking a story makes it happen. And so I told you a story, told you it was yours. A long time ago, so long ago, no one remembers when, Bear Slayer Boy rose out of the river's mud, his ears, enormous, trimmed with fur and as large as meat pies. With those ears, he could hear the stirrings of field mice three countries away. His gifts of discernment were unparalleled. Bear Slayer could hear how the heartbeat changes, how the voice tightens when someone tells a lie. He could hear the sweet caroling of the songbirds, and he knew what the fish in the river were thinking. Smart and wise, Bear Slayer, though a boy, was also strong and courageous. Once, when he was walking in the woods, a bear ambushed him. Without hesitation, Bear Slayer, using only his hands, slew that bear, ripping it apart at the jaws. This story is a door opening, a door closing. The words are hinges, self-oiling through the act of repeated recitation. Repetition being a form of love, I told you this story every night during those magical swift years of your childhood. How big were those ears? You often asked, your voice small in the growing darkness. Bigger than mine? You needed to know you were not alone in your oddity, that your outsized ears were not a mistake, but a marvel. I leaned over you, turning chant to parable, these words being like interlocking teeth of a zipper. You unzipped the teeth of the story, crawled inside its dark, capacious interior, and made it your own.
Thank you. That passage refers to the idea of the story in so many different ways. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the importance of story and how it relates to this novel, The Hidden Letters of Velta B?
Yeah, I think story is absolutely essential to this story, which, as you noted, it is built upon layers and layers of story. So we have this bear slayer myth that every Latvian knows and tells, and it's a story that they love. They told it during the occupations. It was a story that gave hope when Latvia was being occupied by first the Russians, then the Germans, then the Soviets. And it was something that could be a banner under which people could rally. But story is essential as a binding thread throughout the different narratives that people tell in this story. They have very conflicting, diverse, alternate, colliding accounts of history, which I think is probably true in a lot of countries, but it's true in Latvia because there's the history that the Soviets wrote for them, as occupiers often do. There's the true Latvian history that many Latvians know but aren't talking about because there are painful things there. And then there's the history that's slowly being approved, but no one can exactly agree on everything. There's that history. And then there's the history of, as you mentioned, Velta's letters that get revealed midway through the book. There's other history there, again, very painful. So there are reasons, I think, why we need stories. We need stories to tell us what we believe in, what life is meant for, what's important, how to live. And stories are a form of healing. And so all of these elements come together in the act of storytelling, which is why Inara feels compelled to tell her son all of these stories.
And there were some lines in the book that caught my attention related to stories. At one point you say, why we must tell our stories, sing our songs. This is how we forgive and are forgiven. Which I guess relates to what you just said in a lot of ways. Yeah. And another line, a story is a cloak thicker and more knotted than we suppose, and you compare it to lace.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's power in a story, and what isn't said is sometimes is as significant, if not more so, than what is said, what is seen and visible.
There are throughout the book also these songs, these Dinas.
Dinas, yes.
D-A-I-N-A is how it's spelled. Is that Latvian?
Yes, it is. It is a Latvian term. In Lithuanian, it's dainos. In Latvia, it's dainas. And there's a wonderful story about how these all came to be. And they are very, very old songs that are sung. And some are sung for at funerals, some at weddings, songs that describe how to plow a field, songs that describe the correct way to bake bread, how to court and marry, special songs sung on June 24th, Ligo Day, the Ligo songs. So there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of these songs. And it's point in the mid-19th century, Kristaps Barents realized not everyone was singing them as much as they used to, and he feared that people might start forgetting them. So while the Grimm brothers were collecting fairy tales in Germany, he went about and started collecting all of these dinas. And he asked people in the different provinces and areas of Latvia, please write them down and send them to him. And it's this wonderful story about how little tiny slips of paper came flooding through the mail to him. And over the course of several years, he started compiling and trying to sort them and find a pattern between them all. And he collected something like I'm going to say something like 100,000 of them. There are more than that, but that's what he could collect. And because of his work, you know, the Diana as a metrical form, as a song, as poetry, is very robust, alive and well in Latvia.
Really?
And in fact, when I visited, one of the first things somebody shared with me was a Diana. And I included it in the book. But she said, if you want to understand Latvian culture, let me share with you this. And she said, trouble, my big trouble. I put it under a stone and I stepped over it lightly.
That's great. And so that brings up the question. Why Latvia?
Yes. Yes, it's like the perfect obvious question because I'm not Latvian. My parents aren't Latvian. Nobody in our family is. I have no direct links or ties to Latvia. And I think I just got bit by the Latvian bug at some point in 2004, 2005, somewhere around there. I ran across a book by Agate Netsulis called Woman in Amber. And it was so beautiful, so powerful, so sad. And I thought, I've got to find out more about this country and this history. And there's an amazing writer living here in Portland named Paul Stutoni, and he's half Latvian, half Egyptian, I believe, and he wrote a gorgeous story set in Latvia. And at the same time, same summer, I read these two pieces, and I thought, wow, this is so different. I've read stories written about Germany, about Poland, about occupation in World War II and the rebuilding years. I've seen stories written from those perspectives on history, and this was so different, and also different in language register, in the lyric register, in the syntax. There was a difference, and I thought, this is totally unique. I have to find out more. So that prompted a visit to a bookstore where I said, shared the same story with you. I've read these pieces. They're so different. You have to help me find everything you can about Latvia. And the woman's eyes got very big, and she said, nobody comes in here asking about Latvia, ever. I said, well, you've got to help me. Can you help me? And she pointed to her name tag, and she said, I might be able to help you. And her name tag said, Dace. She said, my name's Dace, and I'm Latvian. And it was like one of those, you couldn't ask for, it was miraculous, really. You couldn't ask for anything better. So that began an 11-year friendship in which she tried to teach me Latvian and also set before me like little series, little tests. You know, if you really want to understand Latvian culture, you need to go check this out. You need to go research X, Y, Z. She said, you need to go to Riga. You need to stand in the river. If you stand in the river, you need to get some mud. If you get some mud, you have to put it in a little jar and bring it back to me. You know, so there are all these cool things. You know, I felt like I was in search of the Holy Grail, and it was wonderful.
Let's talk about the hidden letters themselves. You mentioned those, the letters that Velta wrote. Talk a little bit more about that and why they are so important to Inara.
Yes, so Inara finds in the walls, as she's kind of, she's not really supposed to be in this abandoned manor house, but she's there, she's curious, and she's remembering something from childhood. She's remembering that she saw her mother rooting around in the manor house as if looking for something hidden. And so later, when the manor house is acquired by a German couple, she's employed as their housekeeper. And she likes this because it keeps her connected to a little piece of her own family history. And as she's working for them, she comes across, I think in the floorboards it is, she's down there one day and she sees that there's something underneath and she's pulling them out, these letters. And she has a desperate need to feel that she's a very clever girl and she's convinced that she isn't. So she secrets them home. She doesn't tell her mother that she's found anything that could be important. She's aware that her mother's looking for these letters, but in the way that sometimes daughters know just exactly how to hurt their mothers. She doesn't share this piece of information. So she's got these letters and she starts to read them and she realizes that they are not written in a way that is transparent. It's not clear what it is she's reading. It's in Latvian, but it's not clear what it means. It's very opaque. And then some of the letters are written in musical score. So this feels like, okay, here's a challenge. I'll prove I am clever. I will decode this. And eventually she does. And she discovers that what she has decoded is very painful information. And it's the way I think that a lot of people had to process really horrific events that they witnessed or perhaps participated in. Mm-hmm. And that's where the being forgiven, forgiving, and being forgiven comes in.
You've talked a little about the history of Latvia as we've started our conversation, but maybe just a little bit more. I mean, I looked up a little bit of Latvian history because I realized I knew virtually nothing about it. And tell a little bit more about the history of Latvia and the importance of the early 1990s.
So I'm with you in the same boat. I did not know much about Latvian history when I first started, and then I met Dace, and she gave me many books that were in her mother's personal library, and she gave me that challenge: you have to go to Riga. So I started reading. I did go to Riga, and one of the first things that I saw in the old downtown old city area is the Occupation Museum, which is a wonderful museum. And it is all about the history of Latvia, but with particular special emphasis on the years in which Latvia enjoyed a wonderful and spectacular period of independence between 1918 and 1938. And that was kind of the golden years for Latvia. It was the first time that they were not occupied by anybody, and they had elected their first president, and it was a wonderful time for them. And then at the end of 1938, things really began to change, and they were occupied first by Russia, and then the Germans came in, I believe, into 39 or 40, routed the Russians or the Soviets out, and then the Germans were only there for a brief time, and then the Soviets came back through. So in a short amount of time, they had three occupations. And during that time, it was quite possible for a man to be conscripted into one army and then the other and then the other again, or punished because they had been part of one army. Two brothers could be fighting against each other. It was quite possible for something like that to happen. So it was a very divided time and a difficult time for Latvia. And so with that third occupation, which lasted, until the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of things happened in Latvia that made Latvians, I think, feel like they were being punished for being Latvian. So it was all Russian spoken in the schools at one point. People were told, you want to speak Latvian, fine, but, you do it quietly elsewhere.
Mm. So Inara is chastised. Tells of being chastised for speaking Latvian.
Yes. And I was told stories like this often, so I think it wasn't uncommon to have a not so subtle message that Russian is better. So the history books would take things like inventions that were invented by Latvians and ascribe them to someone else. So I think Latvians felt like their history wasn't their own. Their language was being overwhelmed. The population and the demographic ratios and representation, I think they felt they were being overwhelmed. And at one point in Riga, there were as many Russians as Latvians. And I think that this is where the Dainas became important. This is where something like a story like Bear Slayer becomes important. It pulls people together, and it reminds them of national identity and the fact that they once had been an independent country, and that's very important to Latvians. So they weathered the hard years and came out on the other side. When the Soviet Union withdrew, it was for Latvians a wonderful thing, great rejoicing. There was economic hardship, however. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't a completely seamless transition. And so there was in 92, 93, 94, those were difficult years, as they were for all of the countries that had broken away, very difficult time economically. So this is where the curtain opens on the story, those difficult economic years, the year after the Soviet Union has dissolved, and people are trying to figure out what to do. The lat had been devalued. People lost their savings overnight. So they're just trying to pick the pieces up and move on.
And you also referred to this, the different groups, that they're representations of the different groups in your book, The Hidden Letters of Vel, to be the, I guess you would call them the indigenous Latvians, because they're indigenous people there, right?
Yeah.
The indigenous Latvians, and then the various groups, the Russians, the Germans, the Jews, and they're represented within the characters, yes, in your book, and their attempts, yeah, to get along.
Yes.
If you can talk a little bit about how you imagined that, these different kinds of people would interact and have conflict and sometimes mesh.
Yes, they mesh and they don't mesh. They're in a small town, and I love small towns. They're great because it's a blessing and a curse. Everybody knows everybody else's business. So I thought, I must set this in a small town where everybody knows. And who better? Who would know more than the people who are the grave diggers? They'll know all of the secrets, good and bad, about people. So I made 5 trips, 3 of them to Eastern Latvia, and I decided this is the best area, because there are so many small little towns, and interestingly enough, they are populated by Jews and Roma and people of German background, Poles, Lithuanians, predominantly a Latvian-Russian mixture, but there are these other elements there. So it was the perfect place to go. And I thought, when I went to this very little town, so small I can't find it on a map, it's called Tilja, and the nearest town that is on the map is Balvi. And I went there and I thought, aha, I'm going to see conflict everywhere. I'm going to see people just so upset with each other, and they're going to be fighting about the language referendum and language law issues and politics. And I asked my host, could she show me around a little? Could I go? And she was a teacher. Could I sit in and just observe? And after about a week of this, going everywhere, different churches, different classrooms, town hall, walking around, I said, there's a problem here. Nobody's at each other's throats. If at anything, I think the most exciting moment was somebody was arguing over a shovel. And she said, you know, we get along pretty well. We've been doing this for hundreds of years. I had come with, I had done the typical traveler thing. I had read some things. I had formed some assumptions. I thought Russians and Latvians must just hate each other. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't. And so that was something that was very illuminating to me and good. I think a good thing for me to learn. Mm-hmm. Of course, people get upset from time to time. But what I was hearing in Riga, where there was some contention regarding language issues, and there was some animosity I did see between Russians and Latvians over their ethnicity. I didn't see that in the East, and that was very important for me to know, that there is no unifying statement that covers everybody in the country.
And so the conflicts that do happen in the novel are the kind of conflicts that happen between lots of people, perhaps not necessarily because there are ethnic differences.
Right. It's more about class. I mean, who doesn't feel the injustice of somebody who has way, way more than they know what to do with coming in and buying up all the land? That's a socioeconomic class conflict.
Right.
It had nothing to do with Mr. Zetcha being German or Inara's family being Latvian. It just so happens that that's what they were. It was about the haves and the have-nots.
Right, and he's the new owner of the old cemetery, too.
Yes.
Just totally desecrates it.
Yes.
What he requires his workers to do to it, or his...
Yes, he does the unthinkable, and he asks Inara's father and their family to relocate all of the bodies so that he can develop this choice piece of land. And it is utterly unthinkable but they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he promises, I think I can turn your economic nightmare around. I think this will bring jobs to this little town where they need it. Mm-hmm. And so they go for it.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Gina Ochsner. We're talking about her new book, and it is called The Hidden Letters of Velta B. This is Kathleen Stevenson. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland. How did you get the idea for Morris to have those big fuzzy ears, or furry ears, which give him these extra powers?
Yeah. Well, when I was on a first visit to Latvia, I was in Riga, and I noticed that there was a very large, you know, main drag going through town. It was called Lečplēsis Street. And I asked, what is that? And they said, oh, that's Bear Slayer Street. Mm-hmm. Well, so then I had to know who's Bear Slayer, and then I got the story. And then it seemed the perfect metaphor, and making a metaphor literal, that's all the fun of fiction. So it seemed natural and organic to the story that somebody's going to have these big, enormous ears. And so then this boy does, and people think, aha, he's our savior. He will do something. And it's that reversal of expectation. The ears do something, but not what people think.
And he inherits them.
His father had them too.
In reading about your novel, sometimes it's been referred to in reviews as magic realism. Do you see it in that category? Do you care about that categorization, or how do you feel?
Yeah, I think it's a story that's built upon myth, so it's going to start wobbling in that direction once the writer starts employing things like, you know, boys with enormous ears. I don't mind it a bit if somebody calls it that. I think there's enough there that applies universally, that is realistic, that I think a person who is reading this and they like magic realism or don't can still find something there that keeps them reading and keeps them turning the pages. But the magic realism, you know, it's really just a funhouse mirror. It's just a warped mirror through which to reveal reality. So you can't go very far with magic realism before you're really writing realism. It's just an extended metaphor.
Now, you live in Kaiser, Oregon. And many years ago, I lived very close to Kaiser, and I think near the border of where Salem meets Kaiser. Okay. And I've got to say, I never associated someone who would be writing a version of magic realism living in Kaiser, based on what I know of that area. And you've mentioned that in an interview that your life is kind of much more boring than the novels that you write. Can you talk about how do you get that that storytelling ability from a very normal kind of? You have four children?
Four. Two of them are out of the house. They have flown. They circle every now and then when they sense that food might be nearby. But there's still two in the house. And the quotidian, the ordinary, the boring, the dishes, the laundry, it's there. It's part of life. And I think that early on, I realized I love to read. I'm a girl who grew up around stories. I loved fairy tales. I was so lucky to have a mom who read to me. I had a grandfather who's very much like some of the more bombastic characters in here, who would tell the most outlandish, outrageous tales. And we knew this has to be a lie. This cannot possibly be true. But he told it so well, we never wanted him to stop telling it. No one ever asked him, did that really happen? So I feel lucky to have been around people who like words, who like stories, who tell stories, and I think that must have worked on my imagination early on.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you a little bit more about some of the aspects that you just mentioned in this book. These talk about bombastic, this Uncle Morris, mm-hmm. who's named after. He's an interesting character. Can you talk a little about him and the role he plays in the novel?
Yes. In earlier drafting, in earlier versions, he had a larger role, but we realized he was so bombastic, he threatened to run away with the narrative entirely. So in the revision process, he was pared back a little bit. He's important because he is the reason someone like Little Maris needs to come along. Mm-hmm. People like Uncle Maris, probably well-intentioned, but just completely politically incorrect, saying all the wrong things, hurtful things, doing great harm to the family within his drunken rages. He represents a person who is utterly unreconciled. And his idea of having a pure, all Latvian Latvia with only ethnic Latvians in it is ridiculous, and anyone living there would know this. And yet he persists in his folly, and so, you know, he's a perfect example of somebody who's just a little too patriotic, and in being that way, causes great distress and harm for our narrator and the rest of the family. And so, yes, he is the reason why someone like Little Maris needs to come along and use what he can hear as a means for forging reconciliation between people.
Yeah, he lost a leg.
He lost a leg in Afghanistan.
And when would he have been in Afghanistan? Just to
1978, 79, I think up into 81, 82. It's the Soviet Union's Vietnam. It's their bad war that they could never win, and it's the war that people aren't happy to talk about. And it was the practice in those days to send people from Latvia, Lithuania, Kazakhstan, far reaches of the Soviet domain, and send them to the unpopular, ugly wars.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask, is this an area that you will continue to write about, setting things in this area, or do you think you're not going to be writing about this particular area anymore?
Yeah, I don't know if I will do if I'll do a great amount of work in the Baltics in terms of research and pursuing other narrative ideas. Right now, I'm focusing on Bulgaria and Romania and Moldova. There's a very, very interesting group of Roma people who traditionally, you know, maybe like 80 years ago, 90 years ago, this particular group, they would have been the ones who would have trained bears and then tamed them and then taken them to shows and fairs and things like that. They're called the Ursari, and I've stayed with a couple of different families. They don't have bears anymore. Now they're expert metal workers. So I'm curious, when did they stop doing this? Why did they stop? Mm-hmm. What did it mean to them when they were doing that kind of work? And they are also... this particular smaller group of Romani are literate and do quite a bit of reading and writing and are well-versed in literature, which makes them very, very interesting because most of the other groups, Romani groups around them, are not literate and have no desire to be. So I'm curious, how did they learn to read? Who taught them? Why did they decide this was important? Because mm-hmm. you don't put that together usually with first of all, Romani, and then secondly, traveling Romani who are animal tamers.
Well, that sounds like a lot of potential
for
layers and layers there,
and
too,
layers.
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Gina Ochsner, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you very much. And let me let people know again that the title of your new book, your latest book, is The Hidden Letters of Velta B. And my guest has been Gina Ochsner. I'll spell Gina's last name just because sometimes people want to look it up, O-C-H-S-N-E-R. And Gina Ochsner will be at Woodstock on November 5th, that's Saturday, November 5th, at 10 a.m. She'll be part of a panel called Skeletons in the Closet, Family Secrets. That's at 10 a.m. at the Winningstadt Theater. And she will also appear as part of Lit Crawl that day at an event called Mushroom Foraging with Gina Ochsner and Alexis M. Smith. That again, November 5th, and that's at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at the Ace Hotel. That's at 1022 Southwest Stark. So again, Gina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers on KBOO Portland. If you want to hear this interview again, you can go to our website later today, kboo.fm/betweenthecovers.